This podcast is brought to you by WRFL, Radio Free Lexington. Find us online at WRFL.fm. Catch us on your FM radio while you're in Central Kentucky at 88.1 FM, all the way to the left. Thank you for listening, and please be sure to subscribe.
Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning into WRFL Lexington. It's 4 o'clock, and you're listening to Green Talks, where we explore the people and projects that are using the environmental stewardship fee to promote sustainability in the UK community. I'm your host, Sophie Bevan, and I'm the current director of outreach for the Student Sustainability Council. The funding for the projects featured on our show comes from the environmental stewardship fee, a $4 fee that all UK students pay along with tuition each semester. The ESF, which is expected to generate approximately $190,000 by the end of the school year, is distributed by the Student Sustainability Council, hereafter the SSC, for various projects that enhance the culture of sustainability here at the University of Kentucky. This week, I'm joined by Grace Coy, who is a representative from the Urban Forest Initiative, and also Jill Jones, who is an author and historian, and she will be speaking tonight at UFI's seminar series. So you all, thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having us.
So before we get started, Grace, can you just give a brief overview of what UFI is and what the event is tonight?
Sure. So UFI is short for the Urban Forest Initiative, which is a campus-based group that advocates for the health and sustainability of urban forests, both on campus and in the Lexington community. And we do this through different outreach and education projects. So tonight, part of our outreach is to host the annual seminar series, and we are fortunate enough to have Dr. Jill Jones to give a presentation at the William T. Young Library, and that's going to be in the auditorium. And the event is running from 6 to 8 tonight, and we'll feature a social hour with different environmental community groups from 6 to 7. We're going to have UK catering at the event. And then Dr. Jones is giving a talk titled Urban Forests, a Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. And that is actually the title of her book that she'll be talking about today during the show. So we encourage you to attend. It's going to be a great event, and I'm looking forward to hearing Dr. Jones talk.
Awesome. Thank you. So here in the studio, we have Dr. Jones. And so you are an author and historian. So can you just talk a little bit about how you got your start to like where you are now?
So I began working as a journalist, and I worked for a couple of daily newspapers, including the Bergen Record in New Jersey, which was across from Manhattan, which is where I was living. And then I became a freelance writer, and in the course of that, I ended up doing some stories in the South Bronx, and from that, I began working on my first book. So my first book was A History of the South Bronx. And as I have mentioned to a number of people, probably anyone listening to this radio now thinks of the South Bronx as strictly the birthplace of hip-hop, which it very definitely is. But back when I was writing stories about it, it was, in fact, famous around the world for urban collapse. A lot of the South Bronx kind of looked like it had been bombed to smithereens because of arson fires and then just the collapse of the buildings from the fires. So this was a major part of New York City, and it was kind of an amazing story how you could end up with a big part of New York City, miles and miles of just reduced to abandoned buildings and lots of heaps of trash and a giant urban disaster zone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, so you've written several books, and the most recent one you just published, can you give the full title of it again?
It's actually my sixth book, so it's Urban Forest, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape.
Okay. And so I've heard that it's mostly about the people that are making urban forestry more of a presence in the United States. And can you talk a little bit about what it's all about and how you decided to make this book? Because it sounds like it's slightly different than anything else you've written.
Yes. So the three books I wrote before this were all set in the Gilded Age in America, period between Civil War and World War I, 1870s to, say, 1910s. And that was all about industrializing, urbanizing, a lot of great fortunes. It's when a lot of really important technology came along and changed our lives. So when I had finished writing those books, or was, you know, sort of looking to finish the last one, I was thinking about what was important and what I was interested in, and I feel that climate change is the issue of our day, and will there still be a world we can manage to inhabit? And most of us live in cities, and so what can you do to make life better in cities? And one of the ways you make life better is by having as many trees as you can, because they do so many different things. I mean, they cool cities down. They help absorb stormwater, and we're getting these more and more ferocious kinds of rainstorms. And they're very beautiful. And we now know from really kind of a body of scientific and medical exploration that's been going on for the last, you know, sort of 15 years, and has really picked up the pace in the last five, that trees are just really essential to human well-being.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a scientist who says that trees are a matter of life and death, and he says that because there is an established body of science that shows that pregnant women who are exposed and surrounded by trees have better birth outcomes than those who do not.
Really?
And this has been studied not just in the United States, but in a number of countries in Europe. And really, you know, your birth weight and the state of you as a baby really determines in part kind of your whole life trajectory. So
yeah, definitely.
Being a healthy baby is really important. And if it is in fact the case that being around trees while you're pregnant improves your pregnancy, that's pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm.
That same scientist was just so taken aback, actually, that the one in the United States who sort of did the original studies, that he wondered how he could kind of flip this question and look at it again. And as some people maybe know, that the emerald ash borer has been taking out hundreds of millions of trees, and it started in the Midwest. And trees are also markers of affluence. So he looked at all these counties, and this is the beauty of big data. We live in a world of big data.
Yeah.
And so he actually could know how many hundreds of millions of trees had been lost, because the states have been keeping track of that, by county. And we also have morbidity and mortality stats by county.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to show that in the counties that had had really significant tree loss, because so much of their canopy was ash trees, that the expected level of deaths actually rose significantly.
Hmm.
And so what that meant is that in these counties where people had lost a lot of trees, and therefore there were many fewer trees in their lives, were dying earlier than, you know, would be expected. So that is why he says trees are a matter of life and death. So this aspect of trees, they're, you know, sort of they're really a public health aspect. There was also a wonderful study done up in Toronto. They have a national health system, so they've got really good granular data, I mean, like block by block. And at the same time, Toronto's done very detailed studies of their tree canopy, so they know exactly how many trees they have on any block. And so they were able to do these control situations where they would look at blocks where the demographics were fairly similar, but on, you know, some blocks they had a lot of trees and others they really didn't. And that was actually kind of a funny study because the outcome of it was that people who lived on these blocks with a lot of trees, if you looked at their health data and their demographic data, either their health was as if they were 7 years younger than mm-hmm. they were, so it's like, oh, trees are a fountain of youth, or they made $10,000 a year more.
Yeah.
So trees make you feel richer. And that was actually really persuasive to the
Yeah, definitely.
City Council
I bet.
To want to really up and improve and restore the tree canopy.
Yeah, definitely.
Toronto.
Yeah, and
we'll
I feel
all
like
be younger and richer.
Yeah, perfect. Who doesn't want that? And I feel like just having trees around is such a simple solution to so many of these things you talked about. Like, it's not like a crazy
Well, right.
plan.
That was my feeling. I thought mm-hmm. so. When I was thinking about the climate change issue, I thought, you know, most of us feel fairly helpless in mm-hmm. the face of climate change. I mean, what are we going to do? Well, I mean, nowadays, actually, it turns out you can get, you know, you can have an electrical car, so you just hope that your electricity is not coming from a coal plant.
Yeah.
But, you know, planting trees is really a pretty simple thing you can do mm-hmm. as long as you're doing it in a way that you realize the tree will actually live and become something big enough to kind of make a difference.
Yeah, true. Huh. You kind of touched on this previously, but what is like some of the big effects that you've seen that urban forestry has had on America's history?
So my book really starts in about 1800 because that's when people start moving into cities. And, of course, the people who are moving into cities are used to living in the natural world. They're used to having trees around. They're used to being able to go out in the woods and have access to water to swim. And so when they came into the cities, I mean, suddenly here's this environment which, if they're trees, it's because someone's planted them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you really have to have people who are thinking about that and advocating about that. And so there's really a first urban tree planting movement, and it ends up really gaining speed in the late 19th century when a lot of social movements in the progressive era take off. And it was very successful. In that time, because trees were viewed by public health commissions as really important, there was no air conditioning, and modern medicine really didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So the feeling of the public health commissions was, okay, so it's really important to cool the air down, especially at night, because the human body has to be able to sleep, and you need a certain level of temperature to be able to do that comfortably. And also, remember, in those days, cities were filled with horses and pigs and goats and chickens, and all their droppings are then drying out and going into the air. And
yeah.
So the trees really can absorb a lot of dust and particulates. So the other feeling was that, you know, a really good tree canopy was going to keep the dust down. And this was all really aimed at keeping down levels of child mortality. So you can imagine that's a really persuasive argument.
Yeah,
why
definitely.
Does our city need trees? Well, would you like your children to be safer than they are? So the favorite tree was the American elm, and there are still American elms. And so if you see one, you can see why they were favorite trees. They've got this really fantastic architecture that is really perfect for being in the city. They also grow like weeds, and they put up with incredible insult.
Yeah,
they could put up with a lot of pollution in the days when there's a lot of, you know, coal-fired pollution in the air. And however, in the 1930s, Dutch elm disease came along, and there's sort of this very slow motion death of the elms. I mean, it didn't happen, you know, in 5 years or 10 years. I mean, because there are still elm trees around,
mm-hmm.
but it did take out, we had a lot of monocultures of elm trees lining our streets and in people's yards. This was a very, very beloved tree. At this campus, I think if people talk to their grandparents and ask them about American elms, they probably would, you know, sort of hear about the sadness of the loss of a particular elm in your backyard that you always, you know, hung out in and things like that. So all of this coincided with the fact that there was no air conditioning and we now had modern medicine. And, and so the second tree, you know, movement, urban tree movement to, like, really reforest the cities. So not only had you lost all these elms, you had cars in a way that you didn't before, and so there was a lot of trees lost to street widening, to creating parking lots, and then there just was a lot of development. I mean, if you look at a satellite map of what how green cities were, you know, in the 50s even, and then you look at what it's been every decades since, you just see a steady loss of tree canopy. So the urban forest advocates had to figure out, well, how do you persuade city managers and mayors and, you know, the people who hold the purse strings that trees are a worthy investment? And so an entire new science was developed and investigated that really enables you to look at both an individual tree and trees collectively and to know what kind of ecosystem services they provide. So we now, like, you can go out and measure, say, a big bur oak, and someone can figure out for you how many gallons of stormwater will that tree absorb and mitigate. And then they can translate that into a dollar figure. By the same token, you can do that collectively. So, like, in New York in 2006, Mayor Bloomberg was told that the 600,000 street trees that existed in New York were doing $35 million worth of stormwater mitigation. And that was so persuasive to him, along with the other things they did in terms of cleaning the air, cooling the air. Now, we are not even talking about the fact that trees are beautiful. They also improve your property value. So all of those things together, Bloomberg, and I'm guessing Michael Bloomberg is probably not a person who gave that much thought to trees. He's an engineer and a businessman. But he was so impressed by this new tree science and data, which has been, you know, developed and been accumulating, and the experience with it has, you know, been in the works for almost 20 years, that he quadrupled the forestry budget and launched Million Trees NYC. So New York City has been planting 100,000 trees a year, which is a mind-boggling number.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Over the last 10 years. So this science is really important because it's just completely changed the way arborists can talk to everyone else. And they can talk in terms of services and in dollars and cents.
Yeah, and that's, like, those are the things that the general public will most respond to.
Well, I think the general public ultimately will most respond to the public health aspects of it. So actually, here on your campus, you are now having some initial mindfulness walks that are offered, and we might need Grace to say a little bit about the mindfulness walks. We went on them, and they were developed by a nursing student.
Yeah, so we have a student intern named Brianna Dameron who's developed a series of mindfulness walks on campus. Currently, they are available as audio accessible walks. So you can, you know, take your smartphone, click on which walk you want to use, and then it takes about 10 minutes, and Brianna's voice will come over your earphones, and you can take 10 minutes to relax and have a guided meditation, but also learn a little bit about urban trees. So there is some scientific information worked into that, just to conquer that educative component, but it's executed in a way that kind of stimulates this feeling of calmness and stress reduction.
Yeah.
And we're hoping to begin implementing in-person walks, particularly targeted with UK healthcare and integrated medicine. And so those will be rolling out this spring and summer and hopefully some in the fall.
Yeah. Once again, I like how that's so simple. Like, all of this is just, it makes so much sense, and that's really awesome.
Yeah.
So if you, this is, might be a hard question, but if you had to say what is the most important lesson from your book or experience that you would like people to know, what would that be?
It would be that you actually don't need to be an arborist or any kind of tree professional to get involved or take up this cause of having more trees in cities, because I am not such a person, and yet in Baltimore, I've actually started two tree groups, and of course, the trick is to find a certified arborist.
Yeah, that would be helpful.
Who wants to do this with you, because they can actually execute. But one of the things that really has emerged is that, honestly, just regular old people can take up this cause of tree planting, and it's really fun. I mean, sort of tree people are a self-selected, enjoyable group, and planting trees is fun, and just all the things sort of around trees are fun. And then it's very satisfying because you watch the trees grow.
Yeah.
I mean, I planted a number of trees, not surprisingly, in my yard, and when I lie in bed now on my second floor, I can see the Japanese maple has made it up there. So it's, you know...
Yeah.
There is a real satisfaction.
Yeah, definitely. I have to ask, do you have a favorite tree?
So I have two favorite trees. I really love ginkgo trees, which is kind of politically incorrect because they offer no benefit to the local ecology. I mean, there is... So ginkgo trees are the oldest known continuous plant on the planet. And they are a tree species unto themselves. And if you feel their leaves, you understand that they're like leather. So there is no bird, there is no insect that really has a relationship with the ginkgo tree because they've outlived everything.
Yeah.
Hundreds of millions years old as a kind of a living entity. But I do think they are just exceptionally beautiful. And I love the fact that they're so old and odd. So I do. I really love ginkgo trees, but the other tree in particular that I really love is there is an absolutely spectacular American elm, which is probably about a mile from my house, and I have this very personal relationship with it because I got involved in trees in Baltimore, and therefore I knew the city arborist, and I was going to these tree events, and I went to our local arboretum, and all of the Maryland arborists had gathered as a pro bono thing to work on the trees. And he was there. And I had just that day driven by this spectacular American elm, and it had one of those notices that it was coming down.
Okay.
And I said, why is that tree on Keswick coming down? It looks totally healthy. And he looked at me and he goes, I mean, I could see, it's like, I didn't say that was okay. And the next day, I got an email from him, and he said, that tree is not coming down.
Oh, man, so you stopped it.
Yes. And, I mean, it's really a big, spectacular, I mean, it makes that whole street.
Yeah.
And very clearly what the story was is that there was and still is a car repair place there. And I'm sure they viewed the tree as sort of an inconvenience to
them. Yeah.
And so they probably, you know, asked whoever the arborist was for that area. And this is before our whole city arborist section really rose to new levels of devotion and dedication, starting under this particular arborist. And I'm sure that arborist sort of felt like, well, you know, they want this. And because he was not, didn't have that proper level of dedication and devotion. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, every time I drive by that tree, I always feel great.
Oh, yeah, I would too.
You know, it's a perfect example of how, you know, I got involved.
Yeah.
I saw this tree, I said something to the arborist, and he acted. Mm-hmm. I mean, otherwise, that tree would be gone.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's just sort of that value of networks and so forth that comes kind of inherently if you get involved in things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just as a final question, do you have any advice to students who are interested in forestry or journalism? Like,
well, forestry, yes. But, you know, you go out, you get your forestry degree, and I do believe that urban forestry is really an expanding field and, you know, pretty satisfying. And then, you know, if that's not for you, I mean, you can start your own business. I mean, it's really a field you can be very entrepreneurial.
Mm-hmm.
Journalism, I mean, I went to Columbia Journalism School. I go back every 5 years. I have been told that, you know, if you are apt in the field of digital journalism, I mean, there's a future there. I'm personally somewhat skeptical because I just feel like the economics of journalism are still extremely unclear.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain forms of journalism that are flourishing. I mean, so the New York Times is flourishing, the Washington Post is flourishing. But I look at the local newspapers, which is kind of the farm teams, right? And
yeah,
places to spend a whole, they are not flourishing. Podcasts are flourishing. Maybe they're flourishing. I don't, you know, there's zillions of podcasts. How many of them are going to, like, make it over the long haul? I mean, that's what I don't see with journalism. I don't see what the long haul is.
Yeah.
And the models, for a while, the model was, oh, you know, we figured out on Facebook. Well, then Facebook changes its algorithms and, oh, no one is seeing us anymore. So,
yeah.
I just feel like journalism is, I mean, I came into journalism and the afternoon papers were starting to close. And I said to a friend of mine that I went to journalism school with, I said, you know, I have spent my entire life watching journalism die.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look at the fact that this is a very global world. I live in Baltimore. The Baltimore Sun used to have 5 foreign offices. There are none.
Wow.
I mean, the networks used to have, you know, foreign correspondents all over the world. They gone. I mean, I suppose they have some, but that world where newspapers prided themselves on the ability, like if you were a big enough player, you know, you had some foreign correspondents actually, you know, that were away and, you know, living in these places. I mean, that day seems to be over. So,
mm-hmm.
And I have to say, I feel that Silicon Valley and the digital world, which has pretty much eaten, you know, journalism's lunch, I feel like they've got to take some sort of responsibility because without journalism, I mean, there's not democracy.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you know the motto for the Washington Post.
Mm-mm.
Democracy dies in darkness.
Man.
Yeah.
That's like, it's too real right now. I don't like that. But
well, and, you know, in the early days of the internet, there was a lot of kumbaya about citizen journalists. I mean, you know, journalism is hard work, and people who are doing it for free, I mean, how long is that going to last?
Yeah.
So, I mean, they, you know, I think journalism is incredibly important. It's just, I have been skeptical for years about, you know, sort of where it goes. And when I was at my last reunion, one of the women who founded Vox was there, and that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw that after Facebook changed its algorithm, Vox fired 30 people.
Huh.
Well, because, you know, their model, which is based on what Facebook was doing then, I mean, just shifted under their feet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I feel that, like, you know, Silicon Valley has a responsibility for the fact that they have really undercut the economics of newspapers, and they're just not take or you know, the news media.
Yeah.
And they are not taking responsibility for that.
Yeah. Definitely.
So, I mean, they did the same thing in music.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well,
on that cheery note, go to plant a tree.
Yeah, plant a tree.
Yeah, I feel very optimistic about urban forestry journalism. I think, you know, really, you know, it's all still a huge question.
Yeah, definitely. Well, unfortunately, we have run out of time. But if anyone listening is interested in hearing more of Jill Jones' talk and more about her book, she'll be speaking again tonight at the William T. Young Auditorium at 7. So we hope to see a lot of people there. Just for a few closing announcements, feel free to join the transportation services for UK's 7th annual Bike Week, which is happening right now, and it goes through this Friday, April 13th. The remaining events include the Tour to Downtown Art, which is a unique group ride that showcases some of Lexington's murals, and then on Friday there is a bike-in movie. You can stay up to date with the Student Sustainability Council by going to our website or following us on Instagram or liking us on Facebook. And this has been your host, Sophie. And as always, thank you for listening to Green Talks here on WRFL. Keep it locked.
Hey there. If you're enjoying this podcast from WRFL Lexington, you may enjoy our live radio stream at WRFL.fm and, of course, via radio at 88.1 FM in the Central Kentucky area. We have a wide variety of programs you're sure to enjoy. Just go to WRFL.fm/schedule and see what programs appeal most to you. Thanks again for listening to this podcast from WRFL Lexington.